well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Steve Gutowski of The Reload is going to be with us here in a minute or two. We're going to talk about the NRA's trial in New York, the one where Judge Joel Cohen declined to appoint an independent monitor, but did say that Wayne LaPierre, former executive vice president, cannot serve in a paid capacity with the NRA for the next 10 years. The judge also listing out a number of recommendations that he would like to see the NRA put in place in terms of increasing accountability and allowing for some internal reforms. The NRA and the New York Attorney General are supposed to sit down in the next week or two and talk about the judge's recommendations. We'll talk about those recommendations as well with Steve Gutowski here in just a second. But before we do, let's talk about this for a moment. Economists are warning us about massive tax hikes that could hit your IRA and 401k hard. With inflation rising and global uncertainty, it's no wonder that central banks and many Americans are turning to gold. If you haven't thought about gold yet, now's the time. Trust Priority Gold to help you diversify your savings with gold and silver. Text GOLDEN to 800-405-GOLD for a free gold info guide and see if you qualify for free shipping and storage. Experts agree, physical gold is one of the best ways to fortify your savings. Act now to get your portfolio working for you while the market is golden. Text GOLDEN to 800-405-GOLD to learn more. That's GOLDEN to 800-405-GOLD. And now let's talk with The Reload, Stephen Gutowski, about that NRA trial in New York. Also want to get Stephen's thoughts on the presidential campaign, particularly the spending that we are seeing from the gun control groups. Michael Bloomberg's Everytown announcing $45 million they plan to spend between now and Election Day. Giffords already has come out and said that it plans on spending about $15 million. So that's at least $60 million coming from anti-gun groups directed towards anti-gun candidates. Is there anything like that type of money coming from the pro-Second Amendment side this election cycle? We'll talk about it again with Stephen Gutowski. Take a look and a listen. Stephen, thanks for coming on the show today. It's good to see you, sir.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So I want to talk about the NRA trial. I also want to talk and get your thoughts on what we're seeing in terms of spending this election cycle. You know, Everytown just announced $45 million in spending. Giffords has said it's going to spend $15 million. And I don't know that we're going to see anything like that on the pro-gun side, but which kind of gets us back to the NRA, right? The NRA is the has typically and traditionally been the big dog in terms of campaign spending on the pro-segment side, but I don't know that they've got the money to drop $45 to $60 million this election cycle.
No, I mean they definitely don't at this point, at least. You know, unless they make one of these surprise announcements like the gun control groups have, the NRA is way off pace from not just the 2016 election when they raised and spent like $50 million, but also from 2020 when the total was significantly lower than that. You know, I'd be surprised if they got even close to $20 million in this cycle. You know, they're doing about, last month they did about $500,000 in PAC fundraising. That's the kind that we can see every month that gets reported to the FEC.
Right.
and, you know, that they had done $1.3 million back in 2016 in the same month. So it gives you an idea of how far down they are. Now, to be fair to them, the gun control groups haven't had a huge uptick in their fundraising either. The NRA has decreased more. So you're seeing gun control groups ahead of the NRA and also the other gun rights groups combined. Like the other gun rights groups, PACs are not picking up the slack that the NRA has let out. You have some, like the USCCA's PAC has done fairly well, but they only report on a quarterly basis, so it's a little harder to track exactly how much they're bringing in. But nobody is making up for that gap that the NRA has left. But it does also, to be fair to them, seem like kind of a issue-wide problem until now, where you've got these new announcements from the gun control groups that they're going to be spending a ton of money. I'm a little bit skeptical of those announcements, though, to be honest with you.
You know, we have seen big pronouncements in the past that, you know, if I recall, I think it was Everytown. 2020 that Everytown said they were going to spend $50 million, and they didn't, right? They didn't. Ended up spending less than close. That.
Yeah, I think they spent like $15
million. Yeah.
So now they announced that $50 million number before the pandemic happened. So it seems likely that that had some effect. They never really explained why they didn't.
Yeah, they never put out another press release saying, well, here's why we're not going to spend $50 million after all. So we will see. But, you know, at least on paper and in the press releases, the gun control lobby is signaling that, you know, they're going to be making a major effort to back Kamala Harris and down ticket Democrats. Right. This is not just about the Harris campaign. Every town said is going to be looking at 8 battleground states, including Senate elections. Because of course, you know, if you have the White House and maybe the office of White House or the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention, but you don't have Congress, then you're limited to executive actions, right? And while Kamala Harris said back in 2020 that she would institute a gun ban and mandatory buyback via executive action, as well as new universal background checks, since then we of course had the Supreme Court's decision in Loper Bright. Undoing the Chevron deference. We've seen the Supreme Court turn away the bump stock ban. Lower courts have done the same with force reset triggers, with pistol braces. So, you know, the executive action route is going to be more difficult for Harris than it was just 4 years ago.
Without the Senate, which, even if Harris wins the presidential election, the Senate does seem pretty well teed up for Republicans to take control back just by the map itself. So she would have a very difficult time getting legislation through, I think. And you're right, she'd have to lean more on executive actions, which are more dubious now after the Biden administration.
Yeah, I am too, at least long term. Right now, liberal right doesn't stop any administration from promulgating a rule, trying to enforce a rule, and then getting sued over that rule. Mm-hmm. So you're right. I think long term prospects look better. At least with this court in place. But again, you know, we've heard Joe Biden's plans to reform the Supreme Court. We know that they want to change the makeup of the court without, you know,
a wild card.
Right. So that's kind of where we are with the elections. But let's talk about the NRA trial in New York, the second trial. Right. So this was basically the punishment phase for the organization. Right. We had the individual executives like Wayne LaPierre, Woody Phillips, John Frazier. Some of those individuals had, you know, financial sanctions imposed on them in the first trial. But this was really about, okay, what's the path forward for the organization? Letitia James had wanted a appointment of an independent monitor. Judge Cohen rejected that. She wanted a lifetime ban for Wayne LaPierre to have a paid position with the NRA. He said, nah, we'll do 10 years instead, given that Wayne LaPierre is, what, 74, 75 years old?
Yeah.
That may very well end up being a lifetime ban. I don't know that the NRA would want to bring back an 85-year-old.
He can still volunteer for the NRA if he feels like it. He just can't work for the NRA, basically.
Yes. He could still volunteer. But
they want him.
Yeah, right. <know. laughs> Which is, again, another open question, right? But then the judge also had this list of, they weren't demands, right? He couched them in terms of, hey, these are recommendations. These are steps that I would like to see the NRA take going forward. I think there's about 6 of them. Mm-hmm. And he told the NRA and the Attorney General's office to, you know, get together, hash something out. What have you taken a look at those provisions? And is there anything in there that stands out to you as either odd, extremely onerous, or are these, you know, legitimately steps that the NRA could take that would, in your opinion, improve accountability, transparency, and aid in reforming the organization?
Yeah, I mean, I think clearly these 6 reforms that he's suggesting, this one, I'm a little unclear on how this is going to come out. And I think that's really going to matter a lot to how people will view this case in the end. Like if some of this stuff he wants turned into a court order, like the audit committee, the NRA's audit committee put out a document listing certain reforms that the audit committee thinks that the organization should make, and the judge wants to turn that into a court order. So that sounds like it would have teeth to it, you know, some sort of actual enforcement behind it potentially. The other 5, I'm not as clear on how it goes. I mean, it sounds sort of like he wants them to negotiate a consent decree. You saw this with the NRA's foundation in DC. They ended up settling with the attorney general in DC and agreeing to a consent decree, agreeing to a certain number of reforms the NRA is going to do, and that there's some sort of legal requirement for them to do that. Now, if that's how this part goes, if the NRA gets together with the AG and agrees to do these other 5, you know, all these 6 reforms that judge suggested, then I think, you know, the reformers kind of get most of what they wanted. Not everything, right? The Brewer firm wouldn't necessarily be fired or have to, some reformers, you know, Phil Journey and folks like that wanted Brewer firm fired and have to repay money to the NRA. Nothing like that is in there, but there is stuff like shrinking the board, changing rules for how people are able to get on the ballot to run for the board to make that easier and less controlled by the board itself, which has been a long time complaint from reformers. And then you have, you know, a series of changes like removing people from the audit committee who were on the audit committee when the issues arose that the jury results were related to. So people like Charles Cotton or David Coy would be off the, at least the audit committee, not necessarily out of the organization or off the board, but, you know, so these are significant changes that I think a lot of the reformers have wanted to see. And if they are agreed to in some way that has teeth to it, then that makes this outcome look a lot different. Because what my feeling from, you know, the reporting we have on this, what happened in trial and what the judge ruled, is that he didn't, you know, he likes the people who are internal reformers there, you know, the Doug Hamlin and Sonia Rawling and Bill Bakkenberg and Mike Bond, some of these people who were elected in the recent leadership elections. He has respect for what they've been trying to do internally. He thinks that the NRA is making some progress, but he's not, you know, he still wants them to make a series of changes. He still sees some of these critiques that people have raised as legitimate. He just didn't think that a court-appointed monitor was the right approach to fix the issues, that it was too heavy-handed, that it presented even First Amendment problems, like the NRA's lawyers argued. So, you know, he seems like he's looking for a third way, like something that's a little bit different from what the AG wanted and a little bit different from what the NRA wanted, because the NRA argued for like no changes. Mm-hmm. And so we'll have to see what comes of this, this negotiation that they're going into now. And, you know, the judge warned that basically he wasn't happy with how things have gone at the NRA. And that, but he didn't want to impose a more aggressive or overly aggressive solution. But if things continued to go the way they had in the past, after this case is over, he basically warned that it would come back to him and he wouldn't be as, I guess, lenient or forgiving or understanding the next time around, is sort of the point.
Yeah. In fact, so I've got the transcript here. Jeff Knox, who was one of the reformers who was elected, posted this to the Facebook group. Let me just make sure I get the name right. Members Take Back Our NRA. And I don't know if you've actually seen the transcript, but this is the part where Judge Cohen is actually talking about this. He says, a note of caution, however, for anyone who views this as a sort of green light. He said, in the event of future wrongdoing, which likely would come back to this court in some form, the NRA's failure to police itself in the future will be viewed in the very unfavorable light of this case, with a potentially grim result for those involved and the NRA itself. He said, but the monitorship is not the end of the remedy story. However, I remain open to considering specific and targeted changes to the NRA that may be necessary to provide reasonable assurance in the absence of a monitor against lapses once the bright lights of this litigation have dimmed. And he went on to say, as to the NRA itself, the evidence presented at trial suggested there remain vestiges of the regime that presided over the period of unlawful behavior that still do not recognize their role in failing to identify and rectify the wrongdoing. While the NRA members recently flexed their democratic muscles to promote reform efforts, current NRA leadership continues to place decisive authority in the hands of those who did not take a strong hand against improper behavior and chose instead to close ranks behind a leader despite ample evidence of extraordinary misconduct. Yeah. And then he laid out those six specific reforms that that he would like to see put in place. So, you know, I know that both Letitia James and the NRA has spun Cohen's decision as a win.
Right.
I and this is part of what, you know, Judge Cohen found so concerning is that,
yeah,
you know, he said he in that same earlier time. In the same remarks, he basically said this wasn't a win for the NRA. And yet we're seeing this, you know, these press releases calling this, unprecedented victory. That's not what this was. And so it is clear that Judge Cohen does remain concerned that the old guard, so to speak, is still in a position to continue to avoid accountability. And again, he made it very clear that if things don't continue to change, if there are not more changes to come, that if the NRA gets hauled back before his courtroom, you know, that's when the death penalty could apply, right? I mean, he basically said that would be an option going forward.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, the judge was, it wasn't something where he thought the NRA was, did nothing wrong or was, had completely solved, completely solved their own issues internally. He didn't necessarily buy those arguments from the NRA's lawyers, but he did buy the idea that the solution the attorney general wanted was too much. So, you know, this where, you know, it's not some sort of exoneration for the NRA's leadership, especially the past leadership. But it is something where he wants the NRA to fix itself, is more like he might put in a couple of guidelines or guardrails, you know, like these six reforms that he's asking for, but he wants to see the NRA do it itself. And I think he has some confidence that that could happen given some of the reformers that are in place now and how the membership reacted in the last election. Things like that seem to have changed his view or informed his view on what to do here. He seems to honestly believe that the NRA can turn itself around and that there are people there who are committed to doing that, even if there remain, like he said, vestiges of this old leadership regime. And he seems to want to kind of disempower those folks and empower the new reformers. So, you know, it will largely, I think, regardless of what the judge does and how many teeth, I guess, this later consent decree or whatever it's going to be ends up having, it's still going to largely come down, I think, to the people at the NRA and the people inside the NRA. And if people, you know, if NRA supporters, former members perhaps want to see that change and see the organization get back to the place it used to be, you know, they're going to have to work at it themselves. He doesn't want the government to be fixing the NRA's problems, more or less.
Yeah. All right. So, you know, that brings us back to the reform efforts inside the NRA. And you mentioned Bill Brewer, whose law firm has collected, I think I saw at the Reload, close to $200 million in legal fees since, 2018? Yeah. I mean, that is a huge amount of money. And as you say, the NRA board set up this special litigation committee. So it's that committee that decides whether or not Bruin Associates continues to represent the NRA, right? The board can't just take a vote and say, we want to find new counsel. It has to come from the special litigation committee. So if in order to undo that, the board would have to vote to dissolve the special litigation committee. Have you heard, Stephen, are there efforts or plans underway from the reformers to try to do that at an upcoming board meeting?
I've seen calls for that, but I'm not aware of any specific action on that point. I mean, honestly, I think this ruling that Brewer managed to avoid the monitor, which is what the AG wanted, probably gives him greater credibility on the NRA board. You know, the NRA board, while it did elect these reformer candidates in leadership back in May, you know, it wasn't a unanimous thing. They put Bob Barr as president. There was this idea of trying to keep some consistency while also having some reform efforts, you know, visibly going on. And they decided to keep Bill Brewer at that point. Now, that was a few months before trial, so that could have just been, it would be worse for us to try and switch phases. But this is something of a win for him, right? I mean, just to be completely fair on the analysis of it, it's not a total victory or whatever, but it's something that he can go back and legitimately say, we kept you guys from having a monitor. And I think that'll have a lot of pull with at least a significant percentage of the board. So I don't know where things will go internally as far as Bill Brewer's concerned. Certainly if this, one of the major things about this finding, however this comes out and whatever happens with those six reforms, the litigation, I think they'll basically be over. Like, there's not going to be a lot left to do on the legal front now that this case is finally finished. And that's one thing where, you know, there isn't going to be much of a justification to keep paying such high bills, even if people liked the way that Brewer represented the NRA. So that may be one thing, that's a problem that kind of just solves itself, in the sense that the litigation is over. There's probably not going to be much desire to backfight and try to, you know, there's a small, very vocal portion of the board that doesn't like Bill Brewer and wants to even try to go after him to get money back from him. I don't think that's anywhere near a majority of the board. I don't think they're likely to want to keep going down this path and fighting. I think that most of them are just want to move forward and try to get on. And that's been Doug Hamlin's message too, if you've seen his quotes from the ruling, which I will say the tone in the statements from the NRA this time around are much different from after the jury phase, right? That probably because the judge was very upset with how both sides tried to spin the jury phase in their favor. And the NRA has seemed to have learned at least some lesson on the messaging that they're putting out there. But yeah, I mean, even Hamlin, who's the reformer candidate for EVP, he's much more focused on moving forward and trying to get the NRA out of where it's at right now.
Which, you know, again, I think is where the reform effort should be. I think there does need to be an internal conversation, and I would say not just at the board level, but at the membership level as well, about, you know, what moving forward actually looks like, right? Yeah. Does moving forward mean, okay, we're going to, you know, try to rehabilitate Wayne LaPierre's image? Are we going to try to, you know, downplay the wrongdoing and play up, you know, his work as executive vice president over the decades? Are we going to officially, you know, say the Wayne LaPierre era of the NRA is over and this is NRA 3.0, you know, because obviously the NRA existed long before Wayne LaPierre.
I mean, technically, the LaPierre still owes them millions of dollars from this ruling. And Bob Barr in testimony suggested that they may not actually try to collect that money from him. So I would imagine that's going to continue to be a source of, you know, division inside the NRA, both the board level and the membership level.
Yeah. And I think that's the big takeaway here, right, is that, you know, clearly Judge Cohen believes that more reforms are needed. He doesn't think that a monitor is necessarily the right step to enact those reforms. And I think the reformers would say that more reform is needed, at least some of them. Right now, you know, again, there are board members who would say, look, we've already taken these steps, you know, and you can see these steps that we've taken. That should be enough. But I think that is going to be one of those debates on the board going forward is, you know, again, how much more needs to change. And, you know, my thinking is when you start to see the members come back, when you start to see the donations approach what they were, you know, in 2018, 2019, then that's going to be a sign to me that, OK, the membership feels comfortable with these reforms. I know that there was an initial burst of donations after the elections. Doug Hamlin, when I spoke to him, said that they had met their fundraising goal, had exceeded their fundraising goal, I think, for the first time in 5 years after those elections were held. So whether that's a short-term burst or a long-term burst, I guess, remains to be seen. But you would agree, Stephen, this, you know, while the case may largely be over, the internal efforts to reform the organization is still very much an ongoing issue for the NRA.
Yeah. And I think if you're a reformer, if you're somebody who wants to see change at the NRA and you're willing to come back once all the changes have been made and you're satisfied, one thing to be realistic about is how difficult it's going to be to win back all of the former members who don't pay that close attention to these things. You know, even just getting in front of their eyeballs is going to be difficult. You know, it's hard to go from a, you know, 5.2 million member organization to 3.8 million and then jump back up to that 5 million mark, especially when, you know, Doug Hamlin may be a very competent EVP. Well, you know, obviously that remains to be seen. We'll have to see how he does, but he's not a big name, right? It's going to be difficult for them with more limited resources to try and build back up their reputation. I mean, across the board with membership, with politicians in state houses and in Congress across the country. Like, you know, there's a long road ahead, even if the NRA goes down the perfect path whatever you personally might consider a perfect path, even if they achieve that internally, they still have to go out and sell it to the membership, to congressmen, to legislators across the country, that they, that they're back, you know, that they, that they're, that they've been reformed, that they deserve money again, that they can do the things that they used to do, at the level they used to do them at. And that, that's going to be a marathon, not a sprint.
Absolutely. All right, Stephen, appreciate you joining me on the program today. It's good seeing you, sir. And next time I'll wear my concert t-shirt as well. So I will talk to you soon. And again, if you are not yet a subscriber to The Reload, check out thereload.com. It is fantastic reporting and analysis from Stephen and his team. And always glad to get a chance to have you on the show, Steve.
Hey, love being here.
My thanks again to Stephen for joining us on the program. Looking forward to having him back again in the very near future. All right, before we get to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report, let's talk about this for just a second. At the very heart of our democracy lies a principle that we hold sacred, free speech. It's the cornerstone that supports every freedom we cherish. Yet in today's digital age, discussions about our wealth, our rights, and our future are being silenced or overshadowed in mainstream narratives, leaving many of us feeling voiceless in conversations that are crucial to our financial independence and security. That's where Wealth Protection Research steps in, armed with a mission that's never been more critical. Wealth Protection Research is not a financial advisory firm. They're defenders of free speech, committed to giving a voice to the silenced. But they do seek out financial experts, particularly the voices that challenge prevailing narratives, and especially as we navigate the uncertainties of the 2024 election. In fact, Wealth Protection Research has created a 2024 Election Wealth Protection Report that highlights the three best ideas for protecting and growing your money heading into the 2024 election. It contains ideas the mainstream media won't touch, and you can get it absolutely free when you text IDEAS to 76626 to claim your free copy. If you believe in the sanctity of free speech and the importance of financial freedom, then act now. Text IDEAS to 76626 to claim your free copy of this 2024 Election Protection Report. It's time to widen the scope of what we're told, to hear the ideas the establishment doesn't think you can handle, and to take control of our financial destinies. Text IDEAS to 76626 to claim your free copy. All right, so let's turn our attention now to our recidivist report. Once again, I want to highlight the work of Fox 26 in Houston, Texas, one of the few media outlets that I've seen around the country that is regularly and routinely exploring this very same issue of repeat offenders who are just, you know, in that revolving door of the criminal justice system. Their series is called Breaking Bond. And the latest case that they have found is a guy who's been charged with murder in Harris County, Texas, in the Houston area, while out on deferred probation in nearby Montgomery County, Texas. As Randy Wallace from Fox 26 in Houston reports, since the beginning of this year, 25-year-old DeLeon Davis has been released from the Harris County Jail on five different bonds. Andy Kahan with Crime Stoppers says he forfeits the bonds, doesn't bother showing up for court anymore. He's gone. That happened back on March 24th, and Kahan says in the meantime, he's been charged and convicted in Montgomery County for possession of a prohibited firearm. Actually, I think it was prohibited person possession of a firearm. So in March of this year, Davis became a wanted fugitive for forfeiting his bond in Harris County while he was on probation in Montgomery County. And Kahan says 2 months later is when this murder takes place. According to court documents, Davis is accused of shooting and killing Damian Harris multiple times on May the 6th. The motive still remains unknown. Fox 26 reports that after the shooting, Davis allegedly went to a hotel where he lives and was arrested earlier this month. But again, he was out on probation in one county, should have been checking in with his probation officer. Now, we don't know, maybe he was violating his probation too. But Kahan with Crime Stoppers says, you know, we keep seeing multiple counties that are involved with defendants who are given either bonds, probation, forfeited their bond, but they are allowed to remain in the community to reoffend again. He says if either Harris County or Montgomery County had acted and actually placed Davis behind bars, and again, given the prolific run-ins with the law that Davis has had, one wonders why Montgomery County officials sentenced him to probation and not incarceration for being a prohibited person, possession of a firearm. Whatever. Kahan with Crime Stoppers says, you know, if these counties had done their job, Damian Harris might still be alive. He says, I don't see anywhere in the court document showing that Montgomery County contacted Harris County and said, we've got one of your fugitives. I don't see Harris County saying, hey, Montgomery County, we just got a hit on this guy being in custody, send him back, which is a huge problem. Now, again, I think the underlying issue here is what's going on with the criminal justice system, not just the lack of communication between various jurisdictions, but what judges are doing with these prolific defendants when they are in court. Davis's bond right now on the murder charge set at $1 million. So it looks like he'll be behind bars for at least a little while. But again, should it take a homicide before the criminal justice system acts the way we think it's supposed to? And I would say the answer is no. This is evidence of a deeper problem. And it's not just in Texas. This is happening in jurisdictions all across the country. All right, today's armed citizen story. From Oceanside, California, where police say a resident shot and killed a man suspected of breaking into his home. They are looking at this as a case of self-defense, at least at the moment, according to all of the witness statements. That does appear to be the case. This was about 7:20 Monday evening. Oceanside police said officers dispatched to a home in the 4100 block of Diamond Circle due to a reported assault with a deadly weapon. Police say that there were two people inside the home, a man and a woman, when an unknown man, armed with a rock and a stick, climbed into their backyard and then made his way through a bedroom sliding door. The female resident was actually in the bedroom when the intruder gained entry to the house. They haven't said whether the sliding door was unlocked or whether he used the rock or the stick to break through the glass. But according to police, once he was inside the home, the intruder then threw the rock at the male resident, hit him in the face. Doesn't sound like this is a little pebble either. It sounds like this is a pretty hefty rock. The resident was able to grab a gun, fired three shots, striking the intruder once in the chest. When emergency responders arrived, the intruder, described as a 22-year-old man, was pronounced dead at the scene. According to 10 News in California, police at the scene told the ABC affiliate that the resident who fired the shots was not arrested, that the shooting is being investigated by the Crimes of Violence Unit as a potential incident of self-defense. We will keep our eyes open for any more developments from the Oceanside Police, but I think right now we can call this a defensive gun use. And finally today, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing for a veteran who has passed on, a police officer in the Lone Star State of Texas, who's trying to make sure that World War II veteran gets the funeral and the memorial service that he deserves. KFDM in Beaumont, Texas. I had the story of this police officer in Vidor, Texas, who is doing what he can to honor the memory of Reginald Cochran, who passed away at his home last Wednesday. Jeff Kortz is a police detective in the town of Vidor. He discovered that Cochran had outlived all of his family members, had no relatives, nobody to pay for his funeral, and he said that he wants to ensure that Cochran is laid to rest with the dignity that he deserves. He says, we need to make sure that he gets honored as one of the greatest generation and gets a proper burial. So we started putting stuff together, put stuff out on Facebook, messaged a couple of people to see if we could raise the money. He wants Cochran to be buried alongside other veterans at the Houston National Cemetery. And he's been able to get the one of the local funeral homes in Vidor, Memorial Funeral Home, to make the arrangements basically at cost. And so that is where the donations are being taken, the Memorial Funeral Home. If you live near Vidor, Texas, and you want to ensure that Reginald Cochran, a Marine veteran who served in World War II, is memorialized, is laid to rest there at the National Cemetery, that's how you can help out. And again, I, as the son of a World War II veteran who is no longer with us, I think what Jeff Kortz is doing is absolutely outstanding. And I wish him all the success in the world. And hopefully Mr. Cochran can get that send-off that he deserves. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms Cam and Company. I want to thank you for all of your efforts in supporting our right to keep and bear arms, as well as for checking out Bearing Arms Cam and Company. Now, I know we've been talking a lot about Massachusetts on the show this week, but that's because this is just crazy what is about to transpire here. August 1st, all these new laws go into effect, maybe August 2nd, and it is going to be chaos. I mean, you got a new training curriculum that's supposedly going to be mandated for folks who want to get their license to carry. That curriculum has not been written. So how can instructors use a curriculum that hasn't been written? As we spoke about with Charlie Cook on the program yesterday, the way that Massachusetts has previously defined firearm has now changed to include not just handguns, but rifles and shotguns. But the only problem is that the state of Massachusetts has this roster of firearms that are suitable for sale or have been certified for sale, all of which are handguns. So what happens to the sale of rifles and shotguns now that they're considered, or when they will be considered, firearms? It could be, intentionally or not, that the state of Massachusetts has essentially banned the sale of rifles and shotguns going forward, at least until those long guns are certified for sale by the state. So with just hours before this new law takes effect, and those are just a couple of the provisions. I mean, there's a lot to discuss. I thought it would be a good idea to have Jim Wallace of the Gun Owners Action League join us on the program tomorrow. So we'll talk about the latest revelations that they've uncovered in this bill, but we'll also talk about the upcoming litigation efforts, because it sounds like those are going to be quite extensive as well. So we are going to turn our attention to Massachusetts once again tomorrow, but that's honestly where one of the biggest Second Amendment stories is taking place right now, maybe the biggest Second Amendment story this week. So be sure to check out tomorrow's program, but also check out BearingArms.com throughout the day. We're keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information. The semi-good news out of New Jersey, where a federal judge has said that, well, at least one of the guns on New Jersey's so-called assault weapons list should be available for sale, while upholding the state's ban on large-capacity magazines in a really spurious decision. We've got those stories. We've got the news, again, on the gun control group spending plans in the 2024 election and more. It's all there at BearingArms.com. If you like what you see, I'd also encourage you to become a VIP or VIP Gold member. Just use the promo code SAVEAMERICA, and you can get a significant savings on your membership. And we'll be back with you again tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.